Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Some of writer Bob Sebag's best friends never knew he lived through a plane crash 30 years ago in 1979. He just never talked about it. He'd kicked his way out of the wreck, waited in the deep woods for rescue, healed his broken back in the hospital, checked out, and put it behind him. Then he decided to let the memories and the eight other survivors in. This hour On Point, surviving the crash of Flight 248. You can join the conversation. Have you lived through the eternal moments of a sudden catastrophe like a plane crash? If not, how do you think you'd react? Would you fall apart or be the hero? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A big welcome this hour to our newest listeners in Florida, WUFT 89.1 FM in Gainesville and WJUF in Inverness, Florida. We're glad to have you on board, folks. Joining me now in the studio is writer and journalist Robert Sebag. He is the author of Snowblind, the classic account of the life of a cocaine smuggler. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Playboy, and more. His new book is called Down Around Midnight, a memoir of crash and survival. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob, nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So take us right back, June 1979. You were 32 years old.
That's correct.
When you stepped on Air New England Flight 248 from LaGuardia in New York, bound for Cape Cod. Why were you going there?
I was building a house on Cape Cod. I had the book that you mentioned, Snowblind, had just come off the bestseller list. I was doing pretty well. For the first time in my life, I actually had some money in my pocket. And what I had done is decided to build a house on Cape Cod. I had been up there working on the house and had flown to New York for a weekend of some business to transact, and it was on the way back that night that the trip terminated short of its destination, I guess is the best way to put it. The plane left an hour and a half late out of LaGuardia, and there were passengers aboard for a stop in New Bedford who had been removed from the flight because of fog. And fog is inevitably what is going to cause the problem. It was about 10:45. We had received the announcement that the plane would be landing in 10 minutes.
Otherwise normal flight.
Otherwise normal flight. The fog was very thick. The ceiling was very low. So we were coming in for a landing. Couldn't see anything outside the window, but didn't expect to. And when the announcement came over the cabin speakers from the flight deck that we would be landing, they said, extinguish any cigarettes and fasten your seatbelts. Of course, we don't smoke on flights anymore, but that was part of the announcement. And right. We all went through that those 10 minutes of that anyone who's ever flown is familiar with, that mm-hmm. kind of rock, almost being rocked to sleep in a cradle. As you descend, the cabin pressure changes. And assuming, all of us aboard, that we would be soon touching down on the runway. Well, about 2.5 miles short of the runway at about 140 miles an hour, we hit the woods. We took out 100 yards of trees.
And so this is a crash that came without warning.
Without any warning whatsoever. Thankfully, I have to say that I can't imagine what it might have been like had we known we were going to crash. I hear stories about people who survived these kinds of disasters, and they talk about the minutes leading up to it. We had the luxury of being taken absolutely by surprise.
Can you describe the impact?
Yes, I can now. It would have been difficult for me to describe it. I could only describe it back until recently as surreal. The impact, as I said, we hit it about 140 miles an hour, and what I didn't understand back then was the impact of G-forces. We traveled about 100 yards So coming to a stop that quickly, going from 140 miles an hour to zero that quickly, you pull an enormous amount of G's. And what happens is you gray out strikes first when your peripheral vision disappears, and then you black out without losing consciousness. But that in conjunction with the sound of it, I to this day I couldn't duplicate for you the sound.
In fact, you write in the book, whatever memories time erases, it will never erase the memory of the sound of it.
I try to ask people to imagine taking 8,000 pounds of aircraft aluminum and sticking them into an industrial grinder. This is a sound that was audible a mile away. And try to imagine yourself inside the grinder. The plane was being crushed by trees as we descended through them, and as we slided through the remainder of them, and pulling about six G's, and of course the impact itself. I mean, I broke my back, I broke my pelvis.
The force of the crash took you in your seat.
Yes,
out of the fuselage.
I ripped the seat right out of the fuselage. I mean, the seatbelt held up, the seat did not. I was not the only one to which that happened.
The lap buckle snapped your pelvis, your arm broke through the steel band of your wristwatch.
The physical forces at work will always be, the mechanics conspiring to kill me will remain a mystery, some of them. Suzanne, there was a woman sitting across the aisle from me who would, I guess you might say she became the hero of the night. Everybody, there were several heroes, but she stood out. She told me later that she could not explain why she had to refasten her bra after the impact. As you mentioned, the steel wristband of my watch just exploded. I don't know there are all kinds of serious physical things going on in impact under impact like this.
So there were 10 people on this flight, including the crew. What was the initial reaction by the passengers in the airplane after the crash?
Once we came to rest, and almost instantaneously in my case, and the others who regained consciousness, almost instantaneously came to consciousness, the silence was the most dramatic element, I think, of those few seconds. And as I said, we naturally assumed we were coming in to land, and
did you get up, look around, see who was alive, who didn't make it?
Remember, we're on our knees now, strapped into our... I have one knee on the floor, strapped in. We're covered in jet fuel. The plane is essentially destroyed. The wings are gone. And we had assumed, because it is the natural assumption, that maybe something had happened when we hit the runway. Mm-hmm. And so we're waiting for the sound of an ambulance. We're waiting for the... fire engines to come out onto the runway.
And it never came.
And we were waiting to a man and to a woman for some sort of voice of authority from the flight deck, from the people who were flying the plane to tell us what to do. And that, the pilot was killed instantly. And the co-pilot was almost dead. And in that instant, it became clear to me that if I were going to live, it was up to me.
And you dispel my notions of heroism in this book. At the moment of the crash, you say the camaraderie commonly imagined when dreaming of a scenario like this, that noble feeling of shared sacrifice, never took hold, never happened. You were on your own.
That's right. I must say that not to contradict what you say, but in addition to that, we were trapped in. First of all. Once the realization came to us that we were all alone, the next realization that was almost instantaneous is that we were trapped inside an airplane that could at any moment explode, and we were all soaked in jet fuel. And so I was 32 years old, which made me about 10 years older than anybody else on the plane. I was a year older than the co-pilot. Perhaps it was just by virtue of my age authority kind of settled upon me, but it wasn't because I felt anybody needed the voice of authority. It's because I knew I was going to save my life. I wasn't going to leave anybody behind, And I started barking instructions to some of the younger passengers on the plane, those who could walk. I was having a lot of trouble walking, and I knew that I couldn't carry out the unconscious victims who were in the front of the plane. There were three sisters from Michigan, two of whom were unconscious, one of whom was screaming. And I said, what I said to the first passenger I picked up off the floor after determining that he could walk is, I said, we have to get everybody out of here, and I can't carry those girls.
And so you kicked open the door?
After trying to escape through the window hatches, which were held shut by trees, and having no luck getting out of the plane that way, I went to the rear of the plane, and with the help of this young woman, Suzanne, I opened the air stair door, which is the door by which we had entered the cabin. But it had only dropped open a few inches. It was held shut by trees as well. And so I just started kicking until it was open wide enough to squeeze people through. And at that point, we started evacuating everybody from the plane. There were eight passengers, and we all got out by collectively working together.
With a broken back, a broken pelvis, and all the other broken bones with all the other passengers.
I didn't know the extent of my injuries. I just knew, I did have an instinct that once I stopped moving, I wasn't going to be moving for a long time. I worried that I might never walk again. I didn't know how bad my injuries were. I just knew that things weren't good. I was losing sensation below my waist. But it was at that point, once we could only get maybe 50 feet from the airplane because of the thick woods. We were in the woods in deep fog.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with writer Bob Sebag about Air New England Flight 248, which crashed into deep woods on a foggy night on Cape Cod 30 years ago, and about how he survived that crash, recovering from his injuries, putting the experience behind him until now. His new book is called Down Around Midnight, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. So here you are with the passengers that were on this small plane that night, and you all were trying to get out. Jet fuel's everywhere. You're wondering if this plane's going to explode, go up in flames?
Yes, that was our immediate response. It was the only thing you could think of at the moment following impact. The fumes were overwhelming, So what we did is in breaking out, we finally did break out of the plane, and we got only about maybe 50 feet at the most from the airplane because the brush, the woods, were so thick. It took them an hour and a half to find us. I mean, we were going to spend the next hour and a half in the woods trying to stay alive and keep each other alive.
Except for Suzanne, who seemed to me to be really the heroine of this story, a 19-year-old college student.
That's correct.
Who, after helping pull others from the plane, announces that she is going to leave the site, leave the scene, and go try to find help.
That's right. And what she did is it's difficult even now to know how long she spent in the finding her way to the highway. But she walked. In talking to her recently, she mentioned that, I heard her answer somebody else's question by saying, no, I didn't walk, I ran. Well, I guess she hit it. She found a trail at some point along the way, and then she started running. But just to break through the underbrush of where we were and to find a trail, and I think she found it really only accidentally. She was very lucky to get out at all, out of the woods that night.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the morning. It's after midnight. It's deep fog. Admittedly, it's the summer, so it could have been worse, I guess. And she made her way to the Mid-Cape Highway, where she flagged down a car. And what she did was as typical of Suzanne as anything else she did. At the airport that night, the plane has now disappeared off radar, and that's really the only indication on anybody's part of where it might be. I mean, it didn't take too long for the airline to figure out that the plane had gone down, but they didn't know where it was. And what they were doing is they were telling the there were people waiting at the airport for us, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, family members, and you can imagine how difficult it was for them. Well, they were getting a story from Air New England by then that the plane had been diverted. Go home. We'll give you a call, and let you know. And we'll give you a call when the plane comes in, or whatever the rest of that story was. Suzanne's mother is sitting at the airport. My girlfriend was waiting for me there as well. And Suzanne's mother said to the Air New England employee, she said, "I'm not leaving till my daughter walks through that door." Well, her daughter walked through the door shortly thereafter. That's where she, when she picked up that ride on the highway, she said, "Take me to the airport." And that kind of blew the cover of all the people that were stonewalling at the Air New England ticket counter. And I think, to the best of, that I can determine, by the time Suzanne walked into the airport, the paramedics had probably come pretty close to our position, but it was about an hour and a half before they came upon us.
And it took a while to actually carry you then from the scene out.
We were a half mile from the nearest trail. I talked to the paramedics that I interviewed, and I tracked down a bunch of them. They some of them said they walked a mile with stretchers, and in conditions that are you can imagine. The brush breakers, that they had to have brush breakers to get in there, and they couldn't walk back out on the same trails that the brush breakers had knocked trees into. So it took, as they explained it to me, usually it would take maybe four firemen to carry a stretcher. They needed seven people to carry these stretchers because the terrain was so difficult. It was dark.
Yeah, a few areas as remote and inaccessible left on the Cape, I think is what the report said.
That's right. The Cape Cod Times described it as as our being in the middle of nowhere. And it's still wilderness today.
So this cast of characters on the plane, Bob, with whom you'd had really no meaningful interaction with any of them, except for Suzanne, who was sitting across from you,
right,
who encouraged you to buckle your seatbelt a little tighter.
She actually reached across the aisle and tightened my seatbelt prior to landing. She said, "You know, you ought to tighten that seatbelt." And I had been wearing it loosely around my waist for the duration of the flight, and she actually reached across and pulled it tight. We had a short conversation before she had been running around the cabin talking to the other students on the plane, and everybody had been kind of like just getting to know each other and having fun. And I was kind of keeping to myself. And there was one other passenger who was keeping to himself, and he was the next oldest person. He was a medical student.
Yeah, Paul.
His name is Paul. He's a physician here in Boston today. He was at Mass General and at Harvard Medical School. He and I were the semi-adults on the plane. I mean, I guess I was an adult. We were both officially adults. But we were keeping to ourselves kind of quietly. And the rest of the passengers were college students and younger. And Suzanne finally, it was with the landing announcement that she came and actually took her seat. And then she engaged me in conversation. Mm-hmm. So I had a chance to talk to her for a few minutes.
A couple of other passengers on the plane. Brian, who was an 18-year-old Boston College student who was not wearing his seatbelt, still managed to help transport passengers out of the plane. John, who was a Harvard quarterback, thrown out of the plane through the cockpit window with only a broken nose and a couple of broken ribs.
It's absolutely astonishing that the people of the eight of us who survived, of the nine of us who survived, the three people who were treated and released, that is, not admitted to the hospital with serious injuries, two were not wearing their seatbelts, and one, Suzanne, was sitting in a seat that did not remain attached to the airplane. I wouldn't advise anybody not to wear his seatbelt on an airplane, but nonetheless, this character, John, who he was not wearing his seatbelt. He was thrown through the cockpit and out the front of the airplane. He's the one that saved the co-pilot's life.
So that's the story 30 years ago. How did you come about trying to find the survivors, trying to find these passengers on this plane so many years later? Why did you want to reunite everyone? Why did you want to bring these memories back?
It's interesting that you put it that way. I did not, even now I have not reunited them. I reunited each of them individually with me, and none of them has yet expressed an interest in meeting the others. And that probably goes some distance towards explaining why it took so long to do this. In the initial aftermath of an event like this, I think the natural instinct of anyone is to get in front of it, to put it as far behind you as you can. Back then, when the plane went down, there were reporters on the scene. And the usual collection of firemen and rescue people. I think today, if it had happened, There would be grief counselors. There would be movie of the week producers. There would be literary agents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that people, the tendency would be to bring people together immediately and to sit them down on a panel on television and bring them together for anniversaries. In our case, we all just went our separate ways after an intense 2-hour experience in the middle of the night in which we saved one another's lives. We went our separate ways and never saw one another again. Not one person ever saw one of the other people again.
And so when you called these people out of the blue 30 years after the fact, what did they say to you? What was the sort of, was there a common response?
No, the responses were all different. But where I was lucky, Jane, is that the first person I called was Suzanne. And I had her number because her address had remained, the summer house that her family had on the Cape remained the same. Her number, the number of the family was in the phone book. I mean, I had it from the old newspaper clips and it hadn't changed. So I just made a cold call to her. She just happened to be on the Cape that week because she lives in Manhattan now. And she was very enthusiastic about cooperating. We got together within a couple of days of the phone call. Her response to me was, she said the one question she had asked herself over the years, why I hadn't written about it until now. Well, for that reason. I mean, it takes a lot of, you spend most of your time trying to forget it. And maybe I just ran out of the energy necessary to do that. But her response was positive, and she encouraged me to pursue the project.
Let's get a caller into this conversation now. Doug is in Columbia, South Carolina. Doug, thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you're welcome. I just happened to turn the radio on, my NPR here, and I think that crash happened about 2 miles from my house when I was 12 years old.
Mm. Mm. You remember it?
I remember. Oh, yeah, I remember because a friend of mine's mom was either a photographer or a she had a connection with the newspaper, and she went out there to take pictures the following day. And so my friend and I and this reporter or photographer went to the crash site. And I remember I was convinced that nobody survived. And, of course, I wasn't reading the newspaper back then. It was a very tricky terrain with lots of brush, lots of briars. And it happened 30 years ago, and I was 12 years old. It happened in Yarmouth, correct? Mm. Is that right?
That's right. In Yarmouth.
Yarmouth Port. That was just a few miles from my house as a kid growing up. So
do you still live on the Cape?
No, I live in South Carolina now.
Mm. Well, Doug, thanks for the call and for the memory. Bob, what motivated you that night to survive, and what motivated the others, do you think?
Well, I think that the principal motivating force in the instantaneous reaction to these things is adrenaline. You just the adrenaline pushes you forward. I guess there, and that may be. I guess you could go the other way. You could completely close in and just surrender, and that may be. And in talking to people about it, it seems to me that that's apparently a response to the severity of your injuries. None of us who was conscious was hurt so badly that survival wasn't paramount in our minds. But I think where things broke down in terms of opinion when it came to breaking out of the craft was whether we should stay right where we were or whether we should get out of this this mess. It was the medical student Paul Beppel who told me that moving the girls might make their injuries worse.
Right. So this is a dilemma. What do you do? Yeah. You leave them there or take them out?
Suzanne's response was that it really, how badly they're hurt really doesn't matter if they burn to death. So let's get out of here. I've been told recently in talking to all the people, the firemen and paramedics, that escaping the aircraft is the first priority in a situation like that.
I found the story of your calendar book, that little book that was with you the night of the crash, that you found those many years later that was partly responsible for sort of rekindling all this.
Yes, it was.
Soaked in jet fuel, Covered with Leaves and Pine Needles Those Many Years Later, so interesting because you continued to use that book in its condition after the crash. Is that not right?
That's right. That's the punchline right there. I discovered this thing in the basement. I keep a diary. It's really an expense book for tax purposes. I keep a calendar and have done for many years because I'm self-employed. And down in the basement of my house on the Cape, I ran across this this calendar from 1979, and I was leafing through it, and I assumed in picking it up that it had been soaked. You could see that it had gotten wet at some point, and I assumed some moisture had gotten into the basement. And as I was leafing through it, I saw pine needles and oak leaves in the. And then I realized what had happened to this book. This was aboard the plane with me that night. But my astonishment that I had not remembered that, or it took me so long to realize that, wasn't nearly as great as the astonishment when I realized that the entries ended on June 16th, which was the day before the crash, which was predictable. But the entries picked up again, maybe a month or two later. I actually set this thing down in its condition on my desk and used it as I would any other piece of office equipment. We can read a lot into that. I would assume that I'm just trying to deny it of any significance is really what that was all about, I suppose. But that is the... that's what prompted a lot of the questions I decided to ask.
And so those questions, when they were asked, what was the emotion or what part of the story brought more emotion to the surface for you and for the others as you talked to these people 30 years after the fact?
That may be difficult to answer, Jane, in that... talking to these, it was a very unusual reporting experience for me, and I have to admit that the fact that I brought some reporting to the story made it easier to write. I don't know how I would have written this entirely from memory. The fact that I was able to fall back on my skills and the kind of routines that one goes through as a journalist, gave me a kind of a rhythm and a starting off point and a certain comfort level with dealing with the material. I was able to objectify it in a way where I was talking to these people as sources, as I would in on any other assignment.
There was only one person who didn't want to speak with you.
There was in the end there were I guess we could say I would say two people, but one of those people represented four, and I will explain that. The co-pilot chose not to talk to me, and I have learned since. I wasn't going to force anybody to talk. I knew how difficult it was for me to revisit these events, and anybody who decided that they did not want to revisit this night in their lives deserved to be left alone. The co-pilot decided not to return my phone calls. It's been explained to me since by people who know him and people who come up to me having read the book that the event was so traumatic for him that he just doesn't want to revisit it. Mm. The family of the three sisters who are aboard the plane, for reasons that are very clear, did not want to revisit that night. I can imagine it must have been more traumatic for the parents than it was for the kids.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about living through an airplane crash, about surviving it, putting it behind you, and the memories that linger decades later. My guest this hour is Bob Sebag, journalist and best-selling author of Snowblind and other nonfiction works. His new book is called Down Around Midnight, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You spoke a little bit about this earlier, Bob, but this notion of media therapy and, if the crash had happened today, have all these young bookers out at the scene trying to get you on all these big shows. I guess in some way that was a relief to you looking back that didn't happen to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, in trying to contemplate, one of the things that I had to ask myself is how would it have been different had it happened today? In those ways that we just mentioned, that you just mentioned, it would be very different. Those people would be pushing to bring us together in that way. What I did is I consulted some people who are professionals in that field, and I asked them the question. I said, you know, is pouring your heart out about these things rather than, your instinct would tell you, well, maybe holding them in isn't such a good thing. Mm-hmm. And the point that it really what it comes down to is pouring your heart out or discussing these things is fine, but not with strangers. You know, you can discuss this with your loved ones. And if you feel you need therapy, to talk to a doctor personally about it or one-on-one. But to air this, speaking about it publicly and airing your or seeking your therapy in public really distorts the experience in such a way that it makes it that much more difficult to overcome. Hmm.
You talk about the changes in the media, of course, huge technological changes 30 years past. When you think about, like, for example, the plane that recently landed on the Hudson River, documented on cell phones and, you know, help coming immediately, people standing out on the wing, you're watching it live on TV. I mean, do you think the response to your crash would have been different had it happened today?
Well, the response would have been, I mean, I don't know that... let's go back. There were no cell phones. There was no GPS. There was no transponder on that particular plane. The crash. I don't think modern technology would have changed the fact. It would have prevented the crash, but it certainly would have changed what happened thereafter, which is probably the more traumatic part of the experience for me. I mean, the impact was over in seconds. The escape was pretty dramatic and pretty traumatic, and it took several minutes. But it was that hour and a half in the woods, not knowing whether we would be found or whether we would be alive when they did find us, that modern technology would have made a big difference in.
I've got to get some listeners in here, Bob. Here's Rick. He's in Columbia, South Carolina. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Bob?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you one thing. How do you deal with the people you couldn't save?
With the pilot who...
Yes. It's a difficult a question to answer. I mean, I don't know that there's one answer to that question. The fact is that in this case, the one person who did not survive, the one person we couldn't save, died. He died instantly. There wasn't even no attempt to save him would have been any good. But it was he, in a lot of ways, who was the focus of our initial anger. You know, he and the airline in general, that kind of undifferentiated anger that you feel in an instant like that, where you, I mean, anger is what, in addition to the adrenaline that propelled us forward. But
because the NTSB report cited pilot error.
Oh, absolutely. There was no question we were not in a position to judge that at the time.
Sure.
All we knew is that this airline that kept us waiting for an hour and a half in New York has now dumped us in the woods and left us alone here. And so our anger is directed at the airline in general, the pilot in particular, even though but it becomes a very dangerous game to play when he doesn't survive. I mean, it's very difficult to remain angry with him. And of course, you have to. There are two kinds of anger. There's that initial anger that you feel that gets your adrenaline going and that helps you save your life. And then there's that long-term anger and bitterness that people can feel in events like this, which are really counterproductive, and you have to get beyond them quickly.
Here's Jonathan. He's in Amherst, Massachusetts. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was struck most by Bob talking about the fact that in response to the trauma, that it did not bring people together. There hasn't been a desire for people to come together as a group and so forth, despite what you usually think of as these kind of happy endings. And I'm a survivor of a family trauma that happened 44 years ago. I was the third of four kids. I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, and my oldest sister committed suicide back before they had a term like teen suicide. So she was almost 19. And it affected all of us, you know, obviously deeply and very different ways. But really, never, even to this day, even with various therapy, I'm a psychotherapist, my brother is a psychiatrist dealing with traumatized refugees in Sweden, my sister is kind of a world-famous photographer cataloging various kinds of trauma, but it hasn't created any cohesion, it hasn't created any kind of sharing in a deeper way that would heal. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I think, is also what Bob said about there were no, you know, services available in that kind of way. Of course, there was no grief counseling right away. And by the time we got family therapy about a year and a half later in Boston, where the family moved, it wasn't executed well. It didn't work. Mm. It didn't help bring people together. Mm.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. Sometimes people just want to move on. There's no automatic bond.
Yes, that's true. And I think that Jonathan's remarks bring up another thought that came to me in trying to decipher that kind of thing in the book, and that is that while this was a collective effort at survival, once we had kind of reached a neutrality where we were, you know, where we had stabilized in the woods, everybody kind of retreated to the privacy of his own thoughts, and I think that's in the end when survival is an individual experience. It's never a collective experience. Everybody retreats to his own interpretation of the events that he's just survived and what the future holds for him.
Here's Jay in Pompano Beach, Florida. Jay, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Bob. Very interesting. I just want to say a few years before your experience, I had one with an airline called Pilgrim Airways. They've been long out of business. I think that was their last flight during the wintertime going up into Bradley Field in Connecticut. My question to you, Bob, is did you or any of the people you talked to on board experience a gut feeling before the flight, before the crash? I have. My whole life has been guided by gut feelings ever since then.
Well, thanks, Jay. It was a difficult flying night anyway. So, you know... I think the people at LaGuardia who were turned away from the flight because they couldn't land in New Bedford were very happy that they didn't get aboard that plane. Suzanne, when she pulled my seatbelt tight, reminded me recently that up to that point, she and some of the other passengers had been talking about crashing simply because I guess they had never been on a small aircraft before and the weather was really terrible and it was kind of slewing around in the air. So there was a certain amount of trepidation among people who probably weren't experienced flyers. But no, I didn't have a sense of there was no premonition or ominous feeling that I had that this wasn't going to be my night.
Here's another call from Pat in Northport, Florida. Pat, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you, Jane and Bob. Great show. It's interesting your comments, Bob, about the folks that lived through that trauma. Their reactions as you tried to contact them. As a young man back in Ohio in the late 60s, I was in the Civil Air Patrol, and we were asked to go out to Kenton, Ohio, where a plane wreck had happened, and it was just as an observer, a person on the ground looking for pieces of this aircraft that had been strewn for miles as it was coming down, and seeing the hulk of that aircraft out in the middle of a vacant cornfield was really traumatic, and for a number of years I... you know, would harken back to that, and it created kind of a white knuckle flyer attitude with me as I grew older. But several years back, I went back to visit that area, found the field that the plane had actually crashed in, and talked to some of the folks that were in the farms around there. And for whatever reason, it was some sort of a catharsis, I guess. It cleared my, you know, conscience, I suppose, from that traumatic viewing.
Put those demons to rest, in a way.
Well, kind of put those demons to rest, exactly. And why, I don't know, because it didn't take away the fact that, you know, many people died on a craft that just disintegrated in the air. It was pretty traumatic. Mm.
Pat, thank you. Bob, did you go back to the Cape, to that spot on the Cape?
Yes, I did.
The plane went down?
I did. And that's how the book closes, actually, with a trip that I made with the help of the Boy Scout Council, which the place where the plane went down is still wilderness today. It is overgrown, however. There's no sign except for the damage to some trees out there where the plane actually took out that 100 yards of forest. One of the things that this response brings up. One of the things that I would like to say is that in now that the book has been published and has been read by a lot of people, I've been doing some touring and doing readings and things. I have been really moved by how traumatic this was for people who did not experience it, people who remembered this event. Just as he mentioned, the president of the Boy Scout Council who took me out there remembers as a kid being given the opportunity to go out and take a look at the crashed airplane, which sat the fuselage of which sat out in the woods for, and he couldn't do it. It was just was too emotional for him to do. It didn't feel right.
And
for
what
him.
Do you think's at the heart of that? Is it this sort of instantaneous loss of, you know, this sense of immortality? I mean, is that sort of widespread,
well,
not just the people? Well, who
may,
were in
it may the it may it may have something to do with that. Certainly, that's what. When people ask questions about where the takeaway value is in this it's very difficult to know what changes would have happened to me anyway. What happened with this flight is that that sense of immortality that you tend to lose over time gradually as you mature as a young person was taken away from me instantaneously, and I presume that much more dramatically for the younger people aboard. You know, these are teenagers. They have a while to go before life gets ugly. But that sense of immortality that we all carry around and that kind of maturity takes away was instantaneously taken away from us in this case. And I think that might be, there's something to be investigated there.
Here's Melissa in South Burlington, Vermont. Melissa, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Hi. I was calling about in response to this show, and I myself was in a pretty bad accident about 6 years ago in Santa Monica, California, where hit by an elderly gentleman who drove through a farmer's market, and 10 people were killed and about 70 injured, and I was one of the seriously injured.
I remember that.
And my struggles over the past 6 years, you know, through the physical recovery, emotional, psychological, and I struggled a lot with survivor's guilt issues, and you know, I'm in the process of actually starting to write a book myself. I'm not sure where it will go, but I feel that it will help kind of process all this. When I was hit by the car, I have no memory of it, and I struggle a lot with that. So I just wanted to share that comment, and maybe, you know, I don't know what Bob has to say about it, you know, if he struggled with issues around survivor's guilt or questions about, you know, why did I survive and others did not, maybe.
Melissa, thank you. Good luck.
Melissa, there's no question about it. I mean, and I'm not the only one. I think everybody in that situation, and certainly all the people I talked to, suffered from survivor guilt. And I think that your experience is perhaps one of the reasons we all do. I mean, what you went through, and the 10 people who lost their lives. I mean, that was much worse than anything that happened to me. It's very difficult when you walk away from something like that to think of yourself as anything but lucky. But that's where survivor guilt comes from. It's the people who didn't survive, and that kind of sense that you carry around for a long time that, you know, the dice came up right for me and shouldn't have. I really owe it to everybody to have perished in that incident. It's a really a terrible thing, but a very natural thing and a universal thing. And one survives it with the passage of time, and I suspect that probably therapy helps in more extreme cases.
Here's another call from Eric in Savannah, Georgia. Eric, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you, Jim, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the last caller talked about survival guilt, because my father was in a very bad car accident where he was the driver, a young driver, and two of his friends in the car did not survive the crash, and he did. And I had already been in a extremely similar car crash myself where everyone in the car survived. But it wasn't until 2 or 3 years after my accident that my mother told me how freaked out my father was about my accident because of his accident. Before that, I had never heard anything from anybody about the accident. Mm-hmm. My grandmother made mention of this accident to me once, and the only time I've ever heard my father say anything, we were having a little kind of a, you know, if you had anything in your life, you know, that you could take back, you know, what would it be? Mm-hmm. And the only thing he said was, you know, I would take back, you know, I would take back that accident because not a day goes by that I don't think about it. He's, you know, he's 60, he's 60 years old, and that happened when he was, what, 17? But not a day goes by that he doesn't think about it, but he never talks about it.
Do you feel the same way, Bob?
Yeah, I think that in his father's case, that there's an added piece there, and that is that his culpability. None of us, you know, and there's a certain purity with surviving an air crash. There's no sense of contributory negligence. It's not like crashing your car in the sense that you have no control over it. We were just victims, pure and simple. But nonetheless, survivor guilt is just as strong. I think that in our case, the co-pilot, probably his survivor guilt might have been a little bit more significant because of the position he was in to have some control over the situation, although not enough.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Robert Sabag. The new book is Down Around Midnight, a story, a memoir of crash and survival. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Jane.
I read your book at the Cape this weekend, not far from where you crashed, and I have to say, it's a very poignant story.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners, at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.